Hi, how you doing? Welcome to another episode of Football Memories and Moments. This one I've been wanting to get from the very start. It's David Squires. David is burst onto the scene, I think, about 3 years ago. He's the cartoonist at The Guardian. And I actually can't remember a time before David's cartoons would come out on a Monday and Tuesday. And they've just become part of the everyday football culture. And there's a reason for that, is that they're absolutely outstanding. They're ranging from the funny ones, the little social observations that aren't just in football. But speaking as an Evertonian, I really do recommend this. Howard Kent, the one, it was magnificent. It was great to catch up with David. I had to get up very early for this one because he lives in Australia, and his memory, although he is actually from Swindon, his memory is Swindon Town's only Premier League season. And it was great to catch up. Fantastic to catch up with them about that, and about how probably Swindon's year in the Premier League denied them a proper education. His moment is talking about John Aloisi's penalty that took Australia through to the 2006 World Cup, and it's a really good insight about what he thought about that. And it was just a fantastic chat to have with him, and I really enjoyed it, and I hope you did. So here it comes.
So we were demoted in 1990, and we, like Swindon fans, had carried this sense of injustice for 2 or 3 years. I was 15 when we were demoted in 1990, and I didn't see in any way that Swindon were guilty of doing anything. In retrospect, yeah, maybe paying players boot money and, you know, not paying your tax isn't completely above board. But I think it was something that all other football clubs were doing, but we were made a bit of an example of. But yeah, when we were promoted again in 93, there was that real sense that finally we'd got where we belonged and where we sort of deserved to be. Ironically, the sort of common feeling amongst Swindon fans is a team we got promoted with in 1990 would have actually had a good shot, or would have fared better in the top flight than we eventually did in 93. But none of us really cared at the time. We were just happy to be up there.
And that's the thing, is so it all starts obviously with the playoff final. Just give us a bit of understanding of that.
I unashamedly say that the 1993 playoff final was the best day of my life. And it might sound pretty tragic, but, you know, I was 18 years old. I was there with all of my friends. At the time, it was the most important thing in my life. I completely blew my A-levels because I spent most of that school year just skipping lessons to study the league table, the fixture list, and just working out what all the implications were, you know. So when we got to Wembley in 93, it just meant everything. We were the first coach there. Our friends and I, we hired a coach and went down for the day that way. And we were pretty much the last ones out. And people who remember the final will know that it was sort of, we raced into a 3-goal lead, and then Leicester pulled us back to a 3-all. And then the clearest penalty in the history of football was given, and we won 4-3. Paul Bowden, probably most famously as a penalty kick expert, that's how people will remember him. He tucked it away, and we won 4-3. And the party in Swindon, I mean, I know that Swindon is already known as like the party central in the United Kingdom. It's the first place that people think of when they think of like a Rio like atmosphere, but that night was extra special. It's an insane. The whole town was out. It was crazy.
There's just a couple of things I want to call up there, David. The Wikipedia entry for this game seems to go against what you've just said there, and saying that Swindon were awarded a contentious penalty after Kevin Poole was alleged to have brought down Steve White in the area. Paul Bowden, I like the idea that you're saying that Swindon is the part of the capital of the area, similar to Rio. So I'm hoping in one of your future cartoons there will be a sort of Jesus-style statue of Paul Bowden somewhere in Twitter, which is, and obviously, every week, go on.
Every week is a struggle not to make every cartoon about the 1993 playoff final. It takes an enormous amount of self-discipline just not to make every cartoon about how that was the most obvious penalty given in football history. The majesty of Paul Bowden.
Was the Paul Bowden penalty, that came after the Wales-Romania game?
It was before. I'm sure every Welsh fan will know that about 3 days after he missed that penalty against Romania, he tucked one away for Swindon against Ipswich Town. It was the most beautifully struck penalty you've ever seen, like right in the side netting. It was the perfect penalty. So that's how I remember him anyway.
I'm sure that's compensation for him. So you go through, but the season doesn't get off to a start, does it? Because if I remember rightly, because of Hoddle.
Hoddle walks out shortly after he got promoted, and Ken Bates, and this might be sort of apocryphal, but I've heard Swindon fans say that Ken Bates was at the playoff final, and a Swindon fan had said to Bates that Hoddle won't come to Chelsea now, and Bates got out a wedge of pound notes and said, "Oh no, this says he will," sort of thing. But and Chelsea at that time weren't exactly a glamorous proposition. They were really in the doldrums and they were yo-yoing between the divisions, and working for Ken Bates probably wasn't ideal for a lot of managers. But ultimately Bates was right, and Hoddle went, and he did a good job there. Fair enough. We also lost Colin Coldwood, who was our captain. Mickey Hazard left. Dave Mitchell, an Australian striker who'd done well for us in the first division, he now says it's the biggest mistake he made of his career. So he turned down the opportunity to play in the Premier League to go off and play for a Turkish club, which turned out to be disastrous for him. We just never replaced the players of that quality. And obviously losing Hoddle, who was player manager at the time and played at the sweeper and was just stroking the ball about from that position. And so as he left, John Gorman, his assistant, was offered the job. And one of my friends, who I won't name, I partly blame for this because he wrote some graffiti on the back of the town end saying Gorman in, and there was a photograph in the local press just after Hoddle had left saying Gorman in. And so the board bowed to that pressure and they hired John Gorman. And although we played some nice football in the Premier League, ultimately we were doomed. And it's remarkable now to think that Gorman stayed in his job for the whole season. We didn't win until the 16th game of the season. It's unimaginable now to think that a club would keep faith with a coach for that long. I sort of blame my friend for his graffiti on the back of the town end for that.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And the season, sorry, go on.
I think that's fair enough personally to blame him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was a maniac anyway, this guy. So, the season started. And I say we didn't win until the 16th game. I think it's fair to say we took a while to find our feet. So we started with, I won't go through every game, but I'll just talk about the start of the season. We lost our first game 3-1 at Sheffield United. And it was an inauspicious start. We had to wear Sheffield United socks because our away kit, rather arrogantly, we'd done that thing where clubs choose to wear a Brazil kit as their away colours. But Sheffield United wore white socks as well, so we had to borrow their away socks. It was already a weird start. Another one of my friends, just as the teams came out, got knocked over by an inflatable Mr. Blobby. And that really set the tone for the season. It was we never really came back from there. So we lost 3-1 at Sheffield United, and then a few days later we lost 1-0 at home to Oldham, like with the last kick of the game. And already that's two six pointers that we've got 0 points from. There were two clubs who we knew we would struggle against all season, and we're already 6 points behind them. Then came a 5-0 drubbing at home to Liverpool on the telly, and even Neil Ruddock scored. And then a slight improvement with a 5-1 defeat at Southampton. So that's the first sort of 2 or 3 weeks of the season. Already we were thinking, well, this is going to be a long, hard season. And it was.
Did you have any, I mean, the hope that you had at the start of the season, was that genuine hope or was that blind hope?
Our only hope was that we would stay up and wouldn't disgrace ourselves. And we would have settled just for not disgracing ourselves. And at that point, it seemed it was just going to be humiliating. Our new signing, Jan Åge Fjørtoft, a Norwegian who we'd seen play really well for Norway against England a few days after Swindon had got promoted. He looked like his feet were made of Lego. He was just dreadful. And the rest of the team didn't look great either. I mean, they brought in Andy Much as someone who they thought could save them at that stage. And it just looked desperate. But then came a goalless draw at Norwich, who were a decent side. And we thought, well, okay, that's 1 point. We won't go down with no points. And from there on in, up till Christmas, actually form was okay, if you ignore the fact that they didn't win until the middle of November. But yeah, maybe I was harsh saying that Gorman should have been sacked at that point. But I was talking to a friend of mine about this recently. It's something we often return to. If we had sacked John Gorman at that time, it's around the same time that Peter Reid was fired from Manchester City, and he was doing a pretty decent job there. And we wondered about this alternate reality where Peter Reid becomes Swindon manager and sorts it out. And really, when you're hanging your hopes on Peter Reid, it's you're not in a great position either, probably. But who knows?
That's it, though, David. So he then goes to Sunderland and turns them into a side that finished. Had a top, a few top 10 finishes. And do you think just to stay down this, as Terry Pratchett calls, the trouser leg of time, do you think, if the players reacted by playing for a name and all right, he wasn't Glenn Hoddle, but he'd won more league titles than Glenn Hoddle.
Yeah.
Do you think that may have had some impact in all seriousness? Do you think playing for a name is what the Swindon Town
yeah,
players
maybe.
Needed?
We had a long relate. We loved a player manager. So, and I think that Peter Reid might still have been a player manager at that point. I could be wrong. But so we had Lou Macari for years and he did a great job. And then Ozzy Ardiles came in and for the first few games, he played a couple of games for us. And then Hoddle. And then after Gorman, Steve McMahon was player manager disastrously. But yeah, I mean, maybe having that influence on the park. I've just remembered that I'm speaking to an Evertonian, so any criticism of Peter Reid isn't really going to fly. But yeah, I think he would have made a difference at that point. But yeah, so we stuck it out for 16 games. Then came a historic 1-0 win against QPR in November. Keith Scott was a striker who had scored from Wickham, who was going to be the one who turned things around. Fjørtoft still was misfiring and dreadful. And then after that, we sort of the form was picked up a bit. We actually scored a lot of goals that season. We scored 47 goals, which was more than seven other clubs, including Aston Villa, who finished 10th. And seven of Aston Villa's goals came against Swindon. So I think we probably should have finished fourth or something. I'm not sure. We can talk a bit about the goals against column if you like.
Yeah, I've just had a quick look at as you can tell on Wikipedia. So and I've done you're in Australia. Obviously, we've you know, we've just had a whitewashing there. And in cricket, there's a big thing about bowlers reaching their tons. So I'll kind of provide the same analogy for, you know, Swindon reached their ton, didn't they?
They did, by the skin of their teeth as well. I mean, they're letting 95 goals going into the last game of the season, home to Leeds, who I don't think had anything to play for and weren't a great team at that point. And yeah, we lost 5-0 at home to Leeds in the last game, and it was just abject. It was really miserable. And yeah, I mean, just some of the, I mentioned that the results against Liverpool and Southampton, but some of the other results that season included losing 4-0 at home to Arsenal. And this was a pretty dreadful Arsenal team. 6-2 away at Everton, which I'm loath to mention to you in particular, but yep, there we are.
Yeah, well, 5-0
away
at Villa.
That was a great
day for me.
You were there?
Well, no, it wasn't, but that was the day that I think me and my friend saw three things happen in 2 minutes, which was we saw our French teacher from school, so we hid from her. And then a massive gust of wind shot down Church Street in Liverpool and knocked over two market stalls. And then the world's biggest cargo plane passed over all in 2 minutes. Honest.
Oh, wow.
And then we got home to see that Everton.
And then a 6-2 victory.
Yeah.
Amazing. So there was that, and then there was a 5-0 defeat at Villa, 7-1 defeat at Newcastle, and then, that 5-0 at home to Leeds. But we did have some good days, you know. We drew with Manchester United in, I think, March, and at that point, it wasn't inconceivable that we might still stay up. Jan Fjortov discovered his goal-scoring touch, and he went absolutely wild after Christmas. He couldn't stop scoring, he only scored 12. But, you know, it was still a vast improvement. The United game in March was one of the craziest games I've ever been to. People probably remember it for for Cantona being sent off for stamping on John Moncur. Yeah. Earlier in the game, a Swindon fan had delivered an open-hand slap to the face of Mark Hughes. That was only about 15 meters in front of me, and this massive, it looked like a sort of agricultural worker just strode forward and slapped Hughes around the face as he bundled into the crowd. It was just bizarre, but I mean, that's the sort of thing that would probably see a game abandoned now, and perhaps rightly so, but it was nuts. And the United players came over and then they saw the size of the gentleman who had delivered the slap and sort of retreated to a safe distance. So there was that. And then after just coming out the ground afterwards, a 2-2 draw. And I just came out to like a scene from Braveheart. You know, there was horses and there was just a huge scrap. Unfortunately, someone punched my friend Dave in the nose, and he was only 16 at the time. And he went into the back of an ambulance and went off to A&E, and he was sat in there with a police dog handler who had released his dog and watched the Alsatian run in a huge circle around the melee and then just come back and bite him on his own hand. So he was in there as well. But it was just a nuts day. This is sort of a minor claim to fame, but Swindon were the only team who scored 2 goals at Old Trafford that season. We did the double over QPR. QPR, mind. We took 4 points off Spurs. We also had a 2-2 draw at Liverpool, which is commonly amongst Swindon fans. That's sort of known as one of our most famous results in our history. And I had a season ticket that season, but I went to most away games as well. And I was a student, so. I mean, this was taking all of my fun. So I went to the most away games, but I turned down the chance to go to Liverpool game for two reasons. Firstly, I figured that even if we went down, we'd be back up the season after. And, you know, we'd found our natural position, yo-yo in between the top two divisions. And secondly, I had the chance to go on a coach trip to the Bristol Beer Keller to see an umpire band And there was a girl that I liked who was also going to that. And I chose romance over Swindon's greatest, you know, away performance, probably in the, one of the greatest in their recent history. So I'm an idiot, essentially.
Does that sum your season up?
That pretty much, yes. Yeah, standing lonely in the Bristol beer cellar, listening to the melodic parps of an umpa band and just drinking really like large glasses of gassy ale. Yeah, it was grim.
Did you get anywhere with the girl or?
No, absolutely. I don't even think she was there. It was the ultimate hiding to nothing. It was, yeah. And that summed up Swindon season. So I moved to Australia in 2009, July 2009, and that was 3.5 years after what is commonly thought to be the greatest day in Australian football history, which is when they beat Uruguay to qualify for the 2006 World Cup in Sydney in November 2005.
So most people in English football of a certain age will know, if I remember rightly, John Aloisi had a spell at Coventry.
He did, yeah. He played in Spain a bit as well, and now he's coach at Brisbane now, and his coaching pedigree isn't great. But he tucked away the penalty that got them promoted. The backstory to this game probably goes back as far as 1969. So according to Johnny Warren, who is the godfather of Australian football, a real sort of missionary for the game in this country, where it's sort of really sneered at and seen as a foreign sport, you know. So he tells a story about how in 1969, Australia had played a World Cup qualifier in Mozambique, and some of the players had hired the services of a local witch doctor, but had left without paying him. And Australia won that game. They didn't qualify for that World Cup. But according to Johnny Warren, the witch doctor placed a curse on the team. Inconveniently, for this story, they did actually qualify for the 1974 World Cup. So if you ignore that and then look at the rest of Australia's sort of football disasters from that point through to 2005, then there is a real catalogue of disaster. You know, they're in the Oceania qualifying, confederation. And what would happen is they would win that with some ease, and then they would have to play a team from South America quite often. Mm-hmm. You probably remember that they played Iran in 1997 when Terry Venables was manager. They lost that, having been, they were in I think they were 3-1 up on aggregate at home. And then a pitch invader came on, and the game was held up for about 15 minutes, and because he completely tangled himself in the net, so it took some time to fix that up. And then immediately afterwards, once the game started, Iran had sort of time to regroup, and they came back and scored 2 late goals and 1 on away goals. So it really was a sort of catalogue of terrible memories for the Australian team. So in, I think, 2003, an Australian TV presenter went back to Mozambique and found another witch doctor and had the curse lifted. Like, he had to have, I think he was sprayed in the face with chicken blood, and various other things happened there. It's obviously all bollocks, but it's a sort of a nice side story. Meanwhile, Australia and Uruguay, who they played in the playoff in 2005, they'd had history as well. So they'd played each other in the playoff in 2001. Uruguay had won 3-1, and the Australian players were given a really tough time at Montevideo Airport. It's reported that they were sort of shoved around, and you know, the usual sort of spoiling tactics that teams some or that fans sometimes do, sort of playing sort of loud music outside the hotel and all the rest of it. And so Australia missed out then. So there was a real, there's a bit of an edge between the two countries when they met again in 2005. At this point as well, there was a huge change in Australian football because Frank Lowy, who owns the Westfield Shopping Centre, has invested a load of cash into Australian football. They'd restructured the league, and they had hired Gus Hiddink as coach. And it was a pivotal moment for Australian football. It was felt that they had to qualify for 2006. They had this great generation of players. They had like Viduka, Kewell, Harry Kay, sorry, Tim Cahill, Schwarzer, Bresciano. It's really seen as a golden generation for Australian football at that point. And so they played Uruguay away. They lost the first leg 1-0, but this time they were prepared. So they had a chartered flight waiting for them straight after the match. Most of the players got onto the plane without even getting changed. And they had sort of massage tables and all the rest of it on the special chartered Qantas plane. Uruguay hadn't been quite as quick with their preparations, and they had to get a flight the next day. There was only 80 hours between the two legs of the games. So they had to get a regular flight, and their striker Richard Morales was stuck in economy, and you know he's complaining that he's sort of 6 foot plus and he's sort of curled up. And yeah, and for once, I've been to a few Australian matches here, and like the atmosphere—it's a bit like England games, you know. It's pretty quiet. It's not like club football. It's that sort of staid atmosphere where fans sort of wait for something to happen. It's quite reactive. But I've watched this game, and it seemed just like they've shipped in a renter crowd from somewhere else because they're loud and they're passionate throughout. They boo the Uruguayan national anthem, which is something that's really unheard of in Australian sport. I'm sure that your listeners might have an idea about, you know, Australian sportsmanship, probably formed from watching the cricket. But yeah, remarkably, booing other countries' national anthems is sort of still seen as the ultimate taboo. But that happened before the game. Alvaro Recoba had said that Uruguay had a divine right to be at the World Cup, and he denied that he'd actually said that. But still, he got booed every touch. There was a big punch up in the tunnel before the game. So Tony Popovich, Australia's fullback, him and Morales apparently had each other around the throat. There's no video. I'd love to have seen video footage of that. It sounds like the sort of Vieira Keane sort of bust up, but if no one had, if Graham Pohl hadn't been there, you know, it's like the Green Cross Code Man sort of thing. You know, Graham Pohl won't always be there to save you. So that all this was going on, and Popovich smashed Recoba in the face within like the first 10 minutes or something of the game, and it looked like he was going to get himself sent off. So Hiddink brought on Harry Kewell, and he almost immediately set up Bresciano for a goal for Australia, and that made it 1-1 on aggregate. And yeah, and then the fateful penalty shootout.
So just looking at some of the sorry, David, looking at some of the game here is that the maddest thing is Hiddink said he planned that cool substitution all along. Is that do you think
Yeah.
that's him taking credit for for something that he's
I think.
kind of made a mistake or what? That seems a bit strange to me that.
Yeah, I think we. I think there's a slight possibility he might be full of shit. There's no way that that was planned. Like, you wouldn't substitute your most commanding you know, presence in the centre of defence within at that point in the first half. So, and it was, it seemed, it, if you watch it again, it is just obvious that Popovic is going to get sent off because he's just flying into tackles. And yeah, it's, I mean, if it was planned, then it was a bizarre tactical decision. It later, actually, once he got to the penalty shootout, Hiddink was planning to bring on Spider Kalach for the who is this sort of huge goalkeeper. He was planning to bring him on for Schwarzer. He was seen as like a penalty specialist, but then Brett Emerton got cramp, and so he couldn't. He had to bring on an outfield player instead. So. So that didn't happen. People might remember Kalach as being the goalkeeper who pretty much threw in a goal against Croatia in the finals themselves a few months later.
Yeah, I remember Leicester doing something similar in a playoff final. They sent on a
six foot seven
keeper, and then Steve Claridge. I think Claridge scored a lovely volley, didn't he? So he wasn't needed.
That's right. Yeah. Was it? I think it might have been Kevin Poole who was about to come off, and he, of course, was the goalkeeper who brought down Steve White in the '93 playoff final. So obviously and blatantly. So maybe the decision. But maybe they were thinking we'll take off Kevin Poole so he doesn't commit another horrendous sticking in foul and give away a penalty.
I tell you what, there's conspiracies here that Ike would be proud of. The feds are onto us, David. The feds are onto us. just before we get into the penalties, looking at you know, you talk about Johnny Warren and the kind of the influence, you know, the influence on the game. Is it reading here? It's saying that he actually died a year before the game was. And do you think that's kind of the penalties was a sweet moment for him?
Yeah, I mean, obviously he was already brown bread, but yeah, certainly the game was covered by SBS, who he used to work for, and another pundit called Les Murray, who just passed away last year. The pair of them were really, like I say, they were pioneers for the game here. And it is bizarre, as someone who comes from, obviously from England, where we've got this, you know, a real football culture and obsession with the game there. And here the hostility towards football is, I'm used to it now, but it is bizarre. The more established sports like Aussie rules and the rugby codes really see football as a threat, you know. And there is an element of racism in there as well. I think the game was popularized here by migrants after the Second World War, mostly from Southern and Central Europe. So it's seen as a foreigner's sport, and there's still a lot of that here. So you'll get cases where, say, if a team wins the Aussie Rules Grand Final, and then they'll sort of, they'll go on a rampage in the town centre or whatever. It's seen as sort of larrikinism, sort of boys will be boys kind of thing. And then the moral panic around football supporters here is bizarre. So yeah, I'm sure if Warren had lived, it would have been, Warren is famous for sort of almost like a Partridge like quote of saying, "I was right," sort of thing. And, He definitely would have said that if he'd lived to see it. Needless to say, Johnny Warren had the last laugh.
So we move on to the penalties and you know, it's never fun, is it? And we're English. We hate penalties. It's cliched, but it's true. It's cliched because it's true. We just simply don't back ourselves on penalties, but. But what was the atmosphere like? What was it like for Australia when they come to penalties? Did they think this was our time?
I generally think that they do. So, and this is something that's prevalent across maybe Australian sports culture, and even within football, where they don't have a huge pedigree on the national, sorry, international stage, they have faith that it will be all right. Whereas, yeah, as an English person, an English fan, you know, as soon as it gets beyond 90 minutes, you think, well, this is ruined. So, yeah, I wasn't there, but I think there was a sense that it would be okay. And maybe not after, Mark Viduka missed the penalty, and after that, probably that might have wavered their sense that everything would be okay. But then Schwarzer, who'd stayed on, he made two great saves, and it set up Aloisi to put in the winner.
And that must have been some feeling for them, mustn't it?
They go on about it endlessly, but it's fair enough. It's a big deal. He ripped his shirt off and he ran off waving it around. And just to contrast that with when Australia qualified for the World Cup this year, Tim Cahill scored two crucial goals. In they had to play two playoff games this time. And Cahill scored a pair of goals against, who was it? I think it was Syria. It was Syria. Yeah. And he celebrated by, he made a gesture which later turned out to be linked to some flight company. And I'm aware that I'm being unpleasant about Everton legend here. But yeah, it was pretty toxic.
There we go. That was a cracking chat with David. I don't know about you, but it took me a long time to get over the vision of the dog doing the full 360, running all the way round to bite the police officer on the arm again. And, you know, some would argue that's justice served. Not me. Not my words, Carol. Top Gear magazine. But it was cracking to speak to David, and you can see David every week in The Guardian. He's also now taking his pencil to warmer climes, well, Germany and France, but you know what I mean. We'll see you next week. Bye now.